Chapter 69. Yes, Pip, dear boy, I've made a gentleman on you. It's me what has done it. I swore that time, sure as ever I earned a guinea, that guinea should go to you. I swore other words, sure as ever I speculated and got rich, you should get rich. I lived rough, that you should live smooth. I worked hard, that you should be above work. What odds, dear boy? Do I tell it, for you to feel obligation? Not a bit. I tell it, for you to know as that there hunted dunghill dog what you kept life in, got his head so high, that he could make a gentleman, and, Pip, hear him. The abhorrence in which I held the man, the dread I had of him, the repugnance with which I shrank from him, could not have been exceeded, if he had been some terrible beast. Look ye here, Pip. I'm your second father. You're my son more to me nor any son. I've put away money, only for you to spend. When I was a hired-out shepherd in a solitary hut, not seeing no faces, but faces of sheep till I half forgot what men's and women's faces was like, I see yourn. I drops my knife many a time in that hut, when I was a-eating my dinner or my supper, and I says, here's the boy again, a-looking at me whiles I eats and drinks. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I see you there many times, as plain as ever I see you on the misty marshes. Lord strike me dead. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I says each time, and I goes out in the air, to say it under the open heavens, but what, if I gets liberty and money, I'll make that boy a gentleman. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and I done it. Why, look at you, dear boy. Look at these here lodgings o' yourn, fit for a lord. A lord? Ah! You shall show money with lords for wagers, and beat him. In his heat and triumph, and in his knowledge, that I had been nearly fainting, he did not remark on my reception of all this. It was the one grain of relief I had. Look ye here, he went on, taking my watch out of my pocket, and turning towards him a ring on my finger, while I recoiled from his touch, as if he had been a snake, a golden and a beauty. That's a gentleman's, I hope. A diamond all set round with rubies, that's a gentleman's, I hope. Look at your linen, fine and beautiful. Look at your clothes, better ain't to be got. And your books too, turning his eyes round the room, mounting up, on their shelves, by hundreds. And you read 'em, don't you? I see you'd been a-reading of 'em when I come in. Ha, ha, ha. You shall read 'em to me, dear boy. And if they're in foreign languages what I don't understand, I shall be just as proud as if I did. Again he took both my hands, and put them to his lips, while my blood ran cold within me. Don't you mind talking, Pip, said he, after again drawing his sleeve over his eyes and forehead, as the click came in his throat which I well remembered, and he was all the more horrible to me, that he was so much in earnest. You can't do better nor keep quiet, dear boy. You ain't looked slowly forward to this as I have. You wasn't prepared for this, as I was. But didn't you never think it might be me? Oh no, 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 I returned, never, never. Well, you see it was me, and single-handed. Never a soul in it, but my own self and Mr. Jaggers. Was there no one else? I asked. No, said he, with a glance of surprise. Who else should there be? And, dear boy, how good-looking you have growed. There's bright eyes somewheres, eh? Isn't there bright eyes somewheres? What you love the thoughts on? Oh, Estella, Estella. They shall be yourn, dear boy, if money can buy 'em. Not that a gentleman like you, so well set up as you, can't win 'em off of his own game, but money shall back you. Let me finish what I was a-telling you, dear boy. From that there hut and that there hiring out, I got money left me by my master which died, and had been the same as me, and got my liberty, and went for myself. In every single thing I went for you. Lord strike a blight upon it, apostrophe I says, whatever it was I went for, if it ain't for him. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it all prospered wonderful. As I give you to understand just now, I'm famous for it. It was the money left me, and the gains of the first few year what I sent home to Mr. Jaggers all for you, when he first come arter you, agreeable to my letter. Oh, that he had never come. That he had left me at the forge far from contented, yet, by comparison happy. And then, dear boy, it was a recompense to me, looky here, to know in secret, that I was making a gentleman. The blood horses of them colonists might fling up the dust over me as I was walking. What do I say? I says to myself, I'm making a better gentleman nor ever you'll be. ... When one of them says to another, he was a convict, a few year ago, and is a ignorant common fellow now, for all he's lucky, ... What do I say? I says to myself, if I ain't a gentleman, nor yet ain't got no learning, I'm the owner of such. All on you owns stock and land, which on you owns a brought up London gentleman. ... This way I kept myself a going. And this way I held steady afore my mind, that I would for certain come one day, and see my boy, and make myself known to him, on his own ground. He laid his hand on my shoulder. I shuddered at the thought, that for anything I knew, his hand might be stained with blood. It weren't easy, Pip, for me to leave them parts, nor yet it weren't safe. But I held to it, and the harder it was, the stronger I held, for I was determined, and my mind firm made up. At last I done it. Dear boy, I done it. I tried to collect my thoughts, but I was stunned. Throughout, I had seemed to myself to attend more to the wind, and the rain than to him. Even now, I could not separate his voice from those voices, though those were loud, and his was silent. Where will you put me, he asked, presently. I must be put somewheres, dear boy. To sleep? Said one. Yes. And to sleep long and sound, he answered. For I've been sea tossed and sea washed, months and months. My friend and companion, said I, rising from the sofa, is absent. You must have his room. He won't come back tomorrow, will he? No, said I, answering almost mechanically, in spite of my utmost efforts. Not tomorrow. Because, looky here, dear boy, he said, dropping his voice, and laying a long finger on my breast in an impressive manner, caution is necessary. How do you mean? Caution? By gee, it's death. What's death? I was sent for life. It's death to come back. There's been overmuch coming back of late years, and I should of a certainty be hanged if took. Nothing was needed but this. The wretched man, after loading wretched me with his gold and silver chains for years, had risked his life to come to me, and I held it there in my keeping. If I had loved him instead of abhorring him, if I had been attracted to him by the strongest admiration and affection, instead of shrinking from him with the strongest repugnance, it could have been no worse. On the contrary, it would have been better, for his preservation would then have naturally and tenderly addressed my heart. My first care was to close the shutters, so that no light might be seen from without, and then to close, and make fast the doors. While I did so, he stood at the table drinking rum and eating biscuit. And when I saw him thus engaged, I saw my convict on the marshes at his meal again. It almost seemed to me, as if he must stoop down presently, to file at his leg. When I had gone into Herbert's room, and had shut off any other communication between it, and the staircase then through the room in which our conversation had been held, I asked him, if he would go to bed. He said yes, but asked me for some of my gentleman's linen, to put on in the morning. I brought it out, and laid it ready for him, and my blood again ran cold, when he again took me by both hands, to give me good night. I got away from him, without knowing how I did it, and mended the fire in the room, where we had been together, and sat down by it, afraid to go to bed. For an hour or more, I remained too stunned to think. And it was not until I began to think, that I began fully, to know how wrecked I was, and how the ship in which I had sailed was gone to pieces. Miss Havisham's intentions towards me, all a mere dream, Estella not designed for me, I only suffered in Satis House as a convenience, a sting for the greedy relations, a model with a mechanical heart, to practice on when no other practice was at hand. Those were the first smarts I had. But, sharpest and deepest pain of all it was for the convict, guilty of I knew not what crimes, and liable to be taken out of those rooms where I sat thinking, and hanged at the Old Bailey door, that I had deserted Joe. I would not have gone back to Joe now, I would not have gone back to Biddy now, for any consideration. Simply, I suppose, because my sense of my own worthless conduct to them was greater than every consideration. No wisdom on earth could have given me the comfort that I should have derived from their simplicity and fidelity, but I could never, never undo what I had done. In every rage of wind and rush of rain, I heard pursuers. Twice, I could have sworn there was a knocking and whispering at the outer door. With these fears upon me, I began either to imagine or recall that I had had mysterious warnings of this man's approach. That, for weeks gone by, I had passed faces in the streets which I had thought like his. That, these likenesses had grown more numerous, as he, coming over the sea, had drawn nearer. That, his wicked spirit had somehow sent these messengers to mine, and that now on this stormy night he was as good as his word, and with me. Crowding up with these reflections, came the reflection that I had seen him with my childish eyes, to be a desperately violent man, that I had heard that other convict reiterate that he had tried to murder him, that I had seen him down in the ditch tearing and fighting like a wild beast. Out of such remembrances I brought into the light of the fire a half-formed terror that it might not be safe to be shut up there with him in the dead of the wild solitary night. This dilated until it filled the room, and impelled me to take a candle, and go in and look at my dreadful burden. He had rolled a handkerchief round his head, and his face was set and lowering in his sleep. But he was asleep, and quietly too, though he had a pistol lying on the pillow. Assured of this, I softly removed the key to the outside of his door, and turned it on him, before I again sat down by the fire. Gradually I slipped from the chair, and lay on the floor. When I awoke, without having parted in my sleep with the perception of my wretchedness, the clocks of the eastward churches were striking five, the candles were wasted out, the fire was dead, and the wind and rain intensified the thick black darkness. This is the end of the second stage of Pip's expectations. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.